Hello and welcome to Fidelity Connects, the Fidelity Investments Canada podcast, connecting you to the world of investing and helping you stay ahead. Portfolio manager Ramona Prasad joins host Pamela Ritchie for today's podcast. Ramona reflects on 2020, a year that required immense flexibility and resilience from an investing perspective. Ramona took a defensive approach at the beginning of the year and shares how Fidelity's research resources allowed her and other portfolio managers to get ahead of the pandemic. For Canadian investors, Ramona has portfolio manager or sub-portfolio manager responsibilities on several funds, including Fidelity U.S. Dividend Fund, Global Monthly Income, Global Dividend, and Fidelity Tactical High Income Fund. Ramona believes that value wins over time, quality enhances downside protection, and capital allocation drives income. If you're looking for dividends, today's podcast is for you. Enjoy. This podcast was recorded on January 27th, 2021. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of Fidelity Investments Canada ULC or its affiliates. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment, tax, or legal advice. It is not an offer to sell or buy, or an endorsement, recommendation, or sponsorship of any entity or security cited. Read a fund's prospectus before investing. Funds are not guaranteed. Their values change frequently, and past performance may not be repeated. Fees, expenses, and commissions are all associated with fund investments.
Congratulations, Ramona. Great to see you. Congratulations on the Lipper.
Thanks so much, and it's my pleasure to be with you all.
We're so glad that you could join us here today. I feel like we should almost sort of pull back and just discuss who dividends are for. I mean, what is the strategy? Who is the right fit for this? Can you just sort of step back and take us through that?
Sure. Well, Global Dividend is really a core strategy for investors looking for three things. One is globally sourced investment returns, of course. Two, though, is downside protection, and three is a reasonable level of income. And when you put those three things together, really what you're getting is really strong risk-adjusted total return over time. And the beauty of dividends, there are several things that they give you. One, especially in today's low-rate environment, is yield and oftentimes higher yield. Two is the potential for inflation protection, because you can get real income growth off of real cash flow growth and certainly from high quality companies. Three, dividends over time have represented a fairly high proportion of total return. So over history, about 40% of total return. And that's even higher, obviously, in drawdowns, because dividends are always positive. And then lastly, if you have enough dividends in your return stream, you get lower volatility than the broad market, because the volatility of dividends is lower than the volatility of the price part of total return. So that's my pitch for dividends.
I like your pitch for dividends. And let's sort of go, I guess, more broadly into your overall strategy, sort of the pillars of your strategy, really your investment beliefs, how you come to the table to approach the investments that you choose.
So if I think about my three goals of return, downside protection, and income, the first thing I believe is that return is really driven by the price that you pay. And the fancy word for that is valuation, but it's really driven by what you pay. What you get is a function of what you pay. So that's the first belief. The second belief is based on my second goal of downside protection. That's driven by the quality of the companies that you invest in. The higher the quality, the better your downside protection in drawdowns. And we see this, the data sort of proved this out. And then lastly, my third goal of income is really a form of capital allocation. And capital allocation, again, tends to be driven by the quality of the company. The higher the quality of the company, typically the better the capital allocation and the better the income profile over time. So truly what I believe in is value and quality.
And you've talked before, I think there's even a specific quote that we have for you about the quality of the journey. Also, obviously, having the destination as your sort of point, but the quality of the journey. I want to talk a little bit about the journey of 2020. It was a wild year. To some extent, when we've talked in the past, you saw things coming sort of through January, February of last year. Sort of, how did you position seeing what you saw going into it and on the way out?
So 2020 really required overall just immense flexibility and resilience. And then in terms of investing, you had to be really tactical. So going into the year, I was defensive just because valuations weren't really on our side and leading economic indicators looked really peaky. And that was a fairly standard positioning. But then our research, I'm so grateful for our research because we were able to sort of get ahead of the pandemic, essentially see it coming. So I pressed that defensive bet really hard and was able to essentially protect downside in all of the strategies through March. But then where the tactical comes in is you saw valuation spreads, valuation differences just blow out in March. And that was basically saying that you had to get involved in the market. So I basically then reversed course really hard and then pressed the other way, which was to start to really increase the value exposure in all the strategies through the rest of the year, because then valuation was again back on our side. You have to have a lot of courage, though, and a lot of stamina to be able to do that. And then now looking forward, the question is it over or is there more to go? And when you look at valuations and, again, those valuation differences, it's still pretty constructive. So throughout the year, I was essentially adding value sort of to match the pace of the pandemic. And today, valuation differences are still, I think, more or less on our side.
Very interesting. Can you go through a little bit on how things turned a bit upside down in terms of what people clung to as defense, how some of those things changed, and then how all other things did not change? But there did seem to be a little bit of a different type of life raft going through that.
Sure. So defense historically is things like staples, really stable, predictable sectors like staples and utilities and telcos and REITs and I think like healthcare. But what was different in this particular drawdown is defense was sort of those things, not as much as in the past. Like utilities were not as defensive as they were historically. Defense was also hyper growth. So if you were a company that could grow through any conditions, including a pandemic hit to the economy, you acted as defense. And so the difference between growth and value really gapped out tremendously in that environment. And if you had a lot of growth exposure, even if it wasn't necessarily traditionally defensive, you did really well. So it was quite tricky because defense was sort of redefined given extremely low rates that sort of put a floor under hypergrowth stocks, given the increase in valuation or the increase in value that you get when you're a hypergrower at very, very low rates.
And what kind of things didn't change? And I'm thinking, you know, we still come back to the fact that on some level, demographics are still kind of the same. I mean, just sort of point out what has not changed as much that you're still looking for in with the same lens.
So, I mean, given that I'm a dividend-oriented investor, what I will say about dividends is what is unchanged are those four things that I mentioned. It's an alternative yield to yield from fixed income, especially attractive in an era of low rates. It gives you a measure of inflation protection when the market is trying to suss out, trying to sort of determine if inflation is a problem, given that you get real income growth off of real cash flow growth. You get a lot of contribution to total return. These are the things that are unchanged. And you get lower volatility than equities, lower volatility than the broad market. What is different, though, in income investing is that if my historical or traditional sources of yield are, again, in staples and utilities and sectors like that, those are fairly expensive. So what does change over time is what I pay for that yield. And I don't like overpaying for anything. So I don't necessarily get my yield from the same place over and over again. So where I'm getting my yield today is different from historically. So in cyclical sectors like financials and energy, there's a ton of yield because those sectors still remain reasonably valued. So I'll give you an example. I can get at least as much yield in banks as I can in utilities for much better dividend growth prospects and much better valuation. So the alpha odds in banks today, in my mind, are much better than they are in utilities. So those are some of the similarities and differences in this investing style at this point in time.
It's very interesting. And because you use sort of dividends to answer part of that question, I'll just put this audience question straight to you. So what part of the market cycle does Global Dividend Fund perform the best in and why? And maybe we'll just ask you to start off with what part of a cycle do you think we're in, first of all?
All indicators point to sort of an early recovery type stage of the cycle. But my caveat is the business cycle framework has not really served us that well over the course of the last 10 years in a highly distorted interest rate environment. But if you had to stick it in the business cycle format, probably early cycle. And then in terms of global dividend, the way that I structure this fund, again, if I'm looking for return, but also downside protection and income, the beta profile of this fund tends to be low. So over the decade plus that I've run this strategy, on average, the beta is in the mid 80s and the active shares in the mid 80s. So that means I run it fairly conservatively, which means that the alpha is not necessarily linear. And that's why we look for risk-adjusted total return over full market cycles. So typically, I'm going to pick up most of my alpha in drawdowns. And you see this bear out in the capture ratios. So in drawdowns, I have pretty good down captures. So the down capture of this fund is low to mid 80s, and the up capture has been in the mid to high 90s, which is sort of the profile that I want. I'll do reasonably well in up markets and really well in down markets. And if you can, based on the sort of mid 80s beta combined with lots of great stock picking off of the excellent research that we have. So if you combine those two, right, sort of a low to mid 80s on the down and mid to high 90s on the up, you get really strong risk adjusted returns over the full course of a market cycle. Where the alpha is lumpy, a lot of it is in mid to late cycle, but over the full market cycle, really good on a risk-adjusted basis. So I think that was the essence of the question.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I mean, can you put into context whether dividends at the moment, at, you know, when you're buying the shares at the right price, are they harder to come by right now? You sort of mentioned later cycle, but right now we're probably in an earlier cycle. I mean, how tough is it to find dividend payers at this moment?
You can always find them. So that's not the issue. The issue is what you'll pay for them. So I sort of, and I've had a lot of spirited debate with the people sort of in charge about what the yield profile of the fund should be. And what I say is, if the yield is too expensive, I'm not buying it. I will actually go underweight yield. I will not necessarily be overexposed to yield, because when it's too expensive, you're risking the total return profile of the strategy. So you can always find it. The question is, where can you find it where it's reasonably valued? Because if you can combine income with great valuation, and I see that again in financials, in energy, in industrials, in some materials, in some discretionary stocks, in some high dispute areas of healthcare, if you can combine income with great valuations, your alpha odds are really strong. So today, I can find it in more cyclical sectors at good valuations than in the more defensive, the historically defensive sectors. The other thing is, if you can get great valuations with low payout ratios that are rising, meaning that your dividend growth is set to rise, and again, this is the case in a lot of cyclical sectors that got obliterated in the pandemic, at good valuations, you tend to do really well over the preceding years. So that's the strategy.
That's a great answer. There are a number of sort of globally focused questions coming in. So just to sort of get into some of those, I'll just ask for your thoughts on, you know, the question mark of sources of income. We have interest rates, obviously, as low as they are, and they are all over the world. What impact is sort of trying to source income in such a low interest rate environment? I mean, how do you, any thoughts on that you can share?
Mm-hmm. So what's happened, it's a really good question. What's happened in this era of sort of what I call fairly distorted rates coming out of the global financial crisis, very, very low rates across the world, is that alternative sources of yield have gotten re-rated. So we saw this kind of in the first half of 2016, so sort of 2015 into 2016, just things like Campbell's soup, things that don't grow a lot, just got re-rated to like 25 times earnings because there was just no yield to be found anywhere else. And on the flip side, things that were rate sensitive in the other direction, like banks, like JP Morgan, got down to about 80-85% of book value, which was implying that rates would never go up again. So things that were sensitive to rates going up just got obliterated. Now, when I think about yield, I'm thinking about what's implied in the valuations. So when yieldy stocks get really expensive, what's being implied in that re-rating is that rates will never go up again. And I will tend to take the other side of that trade. So today, again, rates are low. There's some worry about whether rates will go up on the back of inflation, but expensive sort of defensive companies remain what I call expensive defensives relative to the rest of the market. And I'm finding my yield more in cyclical sectors. So large parts of energy, banks have lots of yield, lots of beaten up discretionary stocks have lots of yield. The pharma stocks, some of them are still really cheap with lots of yield. So more places that would be considered recovery names than the more traditional defensives.
Well, let's go there first then, because there are also questions coming in here, but I just want to go to some of those sort of beaten up names as you discussed. I mean, where does energy fit within your strategy right now?
Right. So energy, as we all know, certainly Canadian investors, was dislocated on both the supply and the demand side. So that means valuations got extremely dislocated going into the peak of the pandemic in March. And where we are today is that in the least, demand is improving. And you could actually argue that supply is improving as well, certainly in, say, something like shale. So if you've got at least demand improving, but maybe both demand and supply improving, and valuations still look reasonably skeptical, then it's a great setup for the sector. So I'm fairly constructive on the sector, and you'll see that in the reported filings where my sector weight is fairly high. So that's where I am on energy. I tend to end up, because my focus is on downside protection as well, I tend to end up in the higher quality parts of energy, such as the integrated oil companies in Canada. And today, things like refiners have my attention because they are extremely leveraged to a recovery in the economy.
Well, we'll go to a question about the UK right now. Some of your thoughts on the market there. Also, the difficulties with Brexit, which seem to be kind of still unfolding, and there seem to be a number of question marks still to see what sort of impact there is, and also challenges with COVID. Is the UK of interest to you? It's had a rough go. How do you look at it in terms of valuations? Is it of interest?
It's definitely of interest. I find a lot of my new, over the last couple of years, great ideas out of the UK. What I always have loved about the UK running these income-oriented strategies is that I can get a very good combination of growth and income out of the UK. It is a market that historically is very friendly to income investors, and so companies tend to prioritize income in their capital allocation alongside growth. So that's sort of one of the hallmarks of investing in UK stocks. And then when we got Brexit, all of a sudden you had all of this really interesting dislocation all over the market. So I tend to own a lot of UK stocks, and certainly in this pandemic, with that country's handling of the pandemic not being as strong either, you got a lot of dislocation. So for instance, there's a travel retailer in the UK that got obliterated, just very, very cheap, that I own, that I've picked up throughout the course of the year. They literally have stores in airports across Europe and even in the US. And since, there are times in the market when there's a belief that we will never get on an airplane again. And so this stock just gets very, very, very cheap. Lots of companies there to invest in that are dislocated.
We've spoken about ESG before, certainly. To what extent do you sort of use that lens when you're looking at stocks? And I guess to an extent, the E, the S, or the G, which becomes more important for your strategies?
So for me, being ESG friendly is a natural outcome of my investment process, as I do believe in taking an all stakeholders approach, being inclusive of all stakeholders. I sort of became sensitized to this at the young age of 19 years old when I was interning for Exxon, the energy company. And at that time, their regard for environmental standards was to meet only the minimum regulatory standard. And I found that dismaying. I thought that they would do much better as a company by trying to protect the environment as much as they could. So that actually turned me off of engineering and sent me to financial services. But since then, it impressed upon me the importance of taking an all stakeholders approach. So whenever I find companies that is taking an all stakeholders approach, I'm very interested. And in fact, this proves out in the process in that all of my funds consistently score higher than the benchmark on ESG scores. So if you rank all of the holdings in the funds on their ESG scores, it aggregates up to higher than the benchmark. So that tells me that having that it is implicit in my process.
Another question coming in asking Ramona about looking at Chinese equities and dividend pair opportunities. How do you look for those, if at all?
So in China and in much of the emerging markets, including India, the focus tends to be on growth over much else. You still find lots of other types of companies, but because these are parts of the market with still lots of what we call white space or growth opportunities, you get a lot of growth orientation. With growth tends to come very high capital requirements oftentimes. Growth is not free, so you have to invest a lot. So typically, if you're investing a lot in these growth opportunities, you don't have a lot of capital left over for dividends. So I don't tend to find a lot of income opportunities in emerging markets, certainly China and India, as I do in more mature markets like the UK, parts of continental Europe, and the US. That being said, there are times where you'll find a more mature company in China or other parts of EM where there's enough free cash flow generation to generate a decent dividend. So I've talked about this company before. There are some beverage companies in China, alcoholic beverages, that is Baijiu, a Chinese staple, that is a stable enough business with decent growth and lots of free cash flow generation that you'll still get a decent dividend off of the income stream. So I will go more in that direction than in the hyper growers, where the capital intensity is so high, you just don't have anything left over for income afterwards.
There's sort of a question that's a bit of an add-on to that, because your mandate is global dividend strategies. Does that sort of thesis play out for most regions around the world, ex perhaps more developed markets? Is it more of a, you're looking for the growth side of it for income?
So emerging markets like China are a little bit tougher on the income side. But what I will say is when we were developing this strategy over 10 years ago, what was exciting is that you can find income all across the world. And sometimes there's some funny, quirky reasons that there's great income in parts of the world. So in Brazil, it's one of the laws that a company has to pay out at least 25% of its earnings in the form of dividends. So you actually get pretty good dividends in Brazil. In South Africa, you get really good dividends off of the companies, and it actually has to do with the end of apartheid and the laws that were enacted about how companies were to be allocated and financed. So it's a very quirky reason in South Africa, but you get tons of dividends. In Australia, it has to do with double taxation, same in New Zealand. So you get lots of dividends in Australia and New Zealand. In the UK, I mentioned that that's a really dividend-friendly country. In Argentina, similar to the UK, very dividend-friendly company. So all across the world, I'm able to source yield. For me, though, it's a question of sourcing it at attractive valuations, because again, if I can get income plus valuation, I get really strong alpha odds. And then the other part of it is I'm constantly looking for, I didn't actually get to this part of your question on the ESG question, the E, the S, the G. I want all three, the E, the S, and the G. Implicit in my process is very high focus on the G, especially the governance, especially in emerging markets. So if I can get really great corporate governance, typically you get very strong capital allocation, which means you get fairly good income.
And I think we only have time probably for one final question. Let's take a sort of, if you ask you to take us through what inflation might mean for your strategy generally, and I guess, you know, concerns about stimulus that's in the system or not, your thoughts on that and potential inflation impacts on your strategy.
So I'll caveat first by saying even the people who are hired to make these predictions often will not get it right. So I'll try not to make too many predictions. It's just very, very hard to predict, number one. But there's a lot of wonder right now about whether we will have inflationary conditions in markets globally. And to the extent that we do, what often you'll see is that there are certain bands of inflation. So, the onset of inflation can often be good for stocks. because it's not too high. It's a Goldilocks level of inflation. It's sort of going from deflation to reflation and a little bit of inflation. And then anything beyond that tends to really worry markets. What I like about equity investing and then dividend investing on top of that is the ability to access real cash flow growth. Because if I'm investing in quality companies, oftentimes they have real pricing. They can price above the rate of inflation. If they have real pricing, that drops down to earnings. So I get real earnings growth. That drops down to cash flows, or that's derived from cash flows. I have real cash flow growth, which means I have real income growth, since income is paid out of cash flows. If I have real income growth, I have the potential to beat inflation. So that's what's great about equities and great about investing in dividends on top of equities. So that's my view on the potential for inflation coming and the benefits of dividend investing.
Ramona Prasad, you are astute, honest, and very engaging. Thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thanks, Pamela, my pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the Fidelity Connects podcast. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe to Fidelity Connects on your podcast platform of choice. And if you like what you're hearing, leave a review or a 5-star rating. You can visit fidelity.ca for more information on future live webcasts, and don't forget to follow Fidelity Canada on Twitter. Thanks again. See you next time.